Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello, hello, Father. How you doing?
Okay, Omri. How are you?
This is attempt number two, seeing as last time we had a bunch of noise outside.
Noise?
It happens life. Occasionally. Yes. Life. The universe.
Yes.
Do you remember what episode we are?
I think a number 14.
14 episodes. There you go. Which means we are approaching the end of season two. That's right. So if you have any questions for us that you'd like us to answer in a Q&A episode, send them our way. And we will do our best to try to answer them. You can send them through our Facebook page, Spies and Lies Podcast, or through our email at grumpygolemproduction@gmail.com. That's grumpygolemproduction@gmail.com. And of course, while you're at it, you can always leave us a review. Welcome to Spies and Lies, an espionage podcast, co-hosted by me, Omri Rose, who spent his childhood living undercover, thanks to his dear old dad and co-host, Jason, a retired former spy master of one of the top intelligence agencies in the world. Without further ado, let's dive into today's episode, The Spies of Genghis Khan. I had trained my men to attack with the speed of the wind. Now they had to learn the guile of the wolf. Oh, people, know that you have committed great sins, and that the great ones among you have committed these sins. If you ask me what proof I have for these words, I say it is because I am the punishment of God. If you had not committed great sins, God would not have sent a punishment like me upon you. Words of Genghis Khan, according to the secret history. Dun dun dun. Genghis Khan was feared throughout the known world at the time of his life. In fact, he used that fear to cultivate an image of the wrath of God, and he used this and wielded this just as efficiently as he wielded a sword or bow in battle.
Yes, it's interesting how he did it, and if we look at it, this is a different era, no modern technology, no quick ways of communication, but still, the word Genghis Khan meant something and had a price tag on his head from the point of view, if you know he's coming, you're doomed.
Pretty much the reputation was if the Mongols were coming for you, you were dead. There was no one who could defeat them. That was the fearsome reputation that they had, that sometimes just word of them coming would cause towns to be completely evacuated and people running for their lives. You know, you didn't want to face the Mongols, that's for sure.
No, you didn't.
But who are the Mongols and who is Genghis Khan? Well, as the name might imply, Genghis Khan was born in 1162 in Mongolia. Genghis Khan did not have a formal education. In fact, he was illiterate. At 9, he was left fatherless and deserted by all but his immediate family. He never read a book in his life. He never studied under any warlord or was tutored by any scholars or anything like that. He developed and trained through the hard knocks of life and through his own military experiences, as well as the harsh existence that was the tribal steppes of Mongolia. This was a hunter-gatherer society, nomads, constantly roaming on their horses from spot to spot, always on the move. Genghis Khan would eventually found the Mongol Empire. This empire, which began in the 12th century, lasted into the 13th century, and some might say even further, depending on how you want to take it. But essentially, it was a massive, massive empire, and Genghis Khan himself was a renowned leader, strategist, and statesman. The Mongol Empire expanded across 11 or 12 million square miles, and in it, trade networks were created between East and West, enabling a cultural exchange. And in addition to that, under the Mongol Empire, there was a religious tolerance, so it wasn't all just scary death. In fact, if you capitulated to the Mongols, and you paid your taxes on time and everything, you found that they were relatively hands-off overlords.
It served them as well when they conquered a place not to invest too much time in it. That's another advantage.
Absolutely. Speed was key to the Mongols. Absolutely key. The Mongol army was also famous for its skilled horsemen and archers. In fact, the Mongols in the steppes of Mongolia from childhood would train with the bow, horseback archery, and it was just part of their life. At its peak, the Mongol Empire was four times the size of Alexander the Great's empire, two times the size of the Roman Empire, and almost half of the world's population today lives in countries that formed part of the Mongol Empire. Genghis Khan's use of tactics, and especially initiative, were legendary. He realized the importance of seizing and maintaining momentum and being in control, even when he was on the defensive. He would always attempt to keep the initiative by constantly keeping his enemies off balance, which is something that our old friend Sun Tzu would have said. You see, the Mongol armies were usually much smaller than their opponents. In the case of when the Mongol armies invaded China, they were at times 100 times smaller than their enemies, who were usually stronger on paper and better armed as well. So they needed strong intelligence and tactics to succeed. And they achieved this.
Yes, they did. It's interesting the combination, as you said, of intelligence and conquering. The question that I ask myself is, what was the purpose of all this conquering? Why did he want to go to all these places? What was there? Was it just, you know, one of those things, because it's there, that's why I want to conquer it? You just don't want to be responsible or for everything? It's a lot of headache, you know, having a people and territory under responsibility. So what motivated a guy like that who started from nothing to decide to be the conqueror of the world?
I mean, it started slowly. He unified his tribe and then sought vengeance against the ones that had betrayed him from other tribes, and then unified those tribes, and then unified the larger group around it. And every time, you know, there's like the border territory, the people next to you, and you try to make peace with them, or they try to fight you, or there's old grudges or old alliances, and things grow and grow. Like, for instance, when he went in with the Khwarizmian Empire in the Middle East, he initially didn't want to fight them. He sent emissaries to them, and they foolishly killed the emissaries, and that caused him to go in and fight them. But also, you know, you see luxury, and when you're expanding as an empire and you have people to support, the easiest way to do that is to keep on growing. That's in laws of economy as well. Growing is better. It's easier. So when you are not growing, it's harder to maintain things. And that's the same thing that happened with the Roman Empire. But we are getting into kind of a larger world history. You know, why did he want to conquer? That's for him to have decided, and many other factors.
Well, we'll have to ask him in the next episode.
Yes, we'll ask him when we do our seance episode. What? No, there's not going to be any seance episodes. Now, the thing is, unlike the image of the barbarian Mongols that we might have in our minds, they were actually very sophisticated and methodical about their conquests. Prior to any military operation, they sent out numerous spies and scouts. Eventually, they had a vast network of spies and informants throughout the known world. Their knowledge didn't come just from spies, though, but also through all of the merchants traveling to and fro, as I mentioned, as well as captives that they would take. They would always look to learn about the inner workings of different territories. They would infiltrate cities and courts, learn the layout of those cities, the design of the defenses, insights on political alliances, military strengths, the composition of the troops and movements and positions of the armies of their opponents. Also, the armaments and the routes of communication, as well as probable places of mobilization for enemy units. In addition to all this, they were also looking for the personal weaknesses of enemy leaders, looking for internal divisions to exploit, or existing rivalries that they could use to weaken alliances or sow dissent. They were particularly interested in rivalries among enemy leadership that they could use to exploit during or before battles. Before setting out on campaign, the spies and agents would also report on the location and quality of grazing grounds. Remember, this is a
This was extremely important to the Mongols to know where they could feed their horses. They had to know the food and the supplies. Also, they were briefed on the weather situation, equally important as well. In fact, when they invaded into Russia and Eastern Europe, the reports that their scouts gave were of frozen lakes and different things, and they were able to use the lakes actually like highways, and they rode across the lakes because they were so frozen, and it was like a super road they just used to traverse very quickly. So all this stuff, really important. In addition to all this, they would sometimes send engineers ahead of time to build bridges if necessary so that it would help with the movement of their troops or prepare siege engines if they knew they were going to have to take a city.
One of the things that pops to mind here is the logistics and how they combine logistics with intelligence. That is that if you look at about all their conquests, they didn't need to get reinforcements from their home country. They were not waiting for the home country or from their original territory for supplies. If it's horses, if it's cattle, if it's food, if it's anything. It's not different from modern warfare, you would say. The logistics are basically, if you don't get it right, you lose the war. And here, I think the part of the intelligence that was interesting for them was what kind of terrain are they going through. Is it something that the horses can feed off? Where is a good place to go? What is a better time to go? That, I think, is fascinating when you think about the kind of intelligence or the information that you need when you go on a campaign. I think that was one of the brilliance of what they did, not to rely on supplies coming from your home country.
Yeah, I mean, they say an army marches on its stomach, and it's absolutely true. And in the case of Genghis Khan and the Mongolian Empire and its armies, it's not that they didn't need any supplies. It's that they were able to plan ahead, and their elite specialized Mongolian troops were able to survive on very little. You know, eventually their armies would comprise of wagon trains and people from different territories that they were incorporated in the army. But their elite Mongolian troops, who were used to this harsh steppe nomadic lifestyle, were used to traversing long distances with their horses. Their horses were smaller Asiatic horses, so they weren't like the European horses that required grain. They could survive just on grass. And the Mongol tribesmen were also used to just eating like this type of meat that they could, like a jerky type of thing that they could put underneath their saddles. And as they rode, it would kind of semi-cook the meat and maintain it and survive on horse blood and milk. So they really were able to survive on very little. And that's also
why they preferred to have mares.
Yes. Than no horses. Yeah, yes. Yeah.
When I'm looking at it from an intelligence point of view, what we don't think when we're looking at the conquering of most of the world by Genghis Khan is how he used intelligence to understand the areas is going to, not so much for the military, but as well for the military, but it was
the people and the terrain.
Not only the terrain and the capability to feed his army as he moves along. That means he won't go to a place where he can't feed his army before or at the time. He will take a detour. He won't take it to that specific season.
Right.
So a lot of the information that came in was not where the army is, like we would think, but what kind of facilities we have that could support our army when we get
the supplies of his troops.
And I found that very interesting.
Also the speed that he was able to move. And again, we're not talking about 21st century or 22nd century speed. We're talking, 10 kilometers,
25 kilometers a day,
depending on different situations. But that is a lot faster than many other armies could usually march. Most armies at the time would march only half the speeds that the Mongol armies could march, and that's not including the elite scouts that I mentioned who were comprised of those Mongolian elite troops.
When we were looking at it, the information about the Mongols, one of the interesting things that came to mind was how many horses they actually had.
Yeah, so each of the, like I said, the main Mongolian riders, and eventually they were incorporated into different things, would not just have one horse, but they would have 3, 4, 5 horses, sometimes more, when they would set out on campaigns, so that they could switch between them as necessary to constantly be riding one that had energy.
And give the horses a chance to rest.
That were the ones that were running before. Now, so you don't run with a horse until they're 90% tired. You run until they're 30% tired. Then you jump on the next one. Then 30% tired, jump on the next one. 30% tired, jump on the next one. And so they're constantly fresh and able to maintain their energy. And as we're already on the topic, If you have more horses, you're kicking up more dust. You look like you're a larger number. You don't have telescopes that see far distances. You just see specks in far away. And so one of the things that they would do is sometimes they would tie ropes and branches to the horses to kick up even more dust. They would have non-warriors, sometimes like their assistants and things as part of the camp, ride the horses as well to appear more large in number. Or they would light more campfires so that even though we said they were usually outnumbered, and they were, the enemy that they would face didn't know that, because they would see more horses, they would see more campfires, and they would think that they're facing this huge amount of troops. And also, they would be everywhere. They wouldn't just be clumped in one place. They would be in the north, and they'd be in the south, because the scouts were able to move around. So psychological warfare.
Yes, we will talk a lot about psychological warfare in this podcast. But again, coming back to the number of horses, now, how much would you say is an army, a Mongol army? I mean, we might touch on it.
We're definitely going to touch on it. But okay. When they would go on campaign, you're jumping ahead here. But when they would go on campaign, they were structured in tens, denominations of tens.
Correct.
So the smallest group was 10, and then 100, and then 1,000, and then 10,000. And 10,000 was called a tumen. And usually on campaign, there would be two or three tumens on campaign. So that's 20 or 30,000 of the elite Mongol units, okay, and then whatever ancillary forces. So
let's say 20,000 people. Each one has four horses. Calculate that.
It's a lot of horses.
A lot of horses. Now, if you need supplies from your hometown, you can't move. So it's crucial to have the intelligence right of the terrain and the capability to feed all these horses. If it's water, if it's grass, if it's anything else you need. This is not one horse. This is not the Wild West with a one horse and switching maybe to another horse. We're talking about huge numbers.
And that's why speed was very key, and planning ahead of time. And again, I'll mention that these are different types of horses than the European horses. They're smaller horses. So they're able to feed just on grass. They still had to find places that had grass, but you know, that was
part of the intelligence.
One of the advantages. And they also maintained their intelligence when they were traveling. They would have cartographers and meteorologists and engineers, usually comprised of Chinese scholars who had come over to their side, and they would make detailed maps of the areas that they conquered. They were always drawing from the skills of the people around them and the people that they conquered, getting information from prisoners and really understanding. I thought it was brilliant. Bring map makers along with you, because again, we have this idea that maps are top-down things of the world, but back then there was no top-down view. You were never in a plane or a hot air balloon back then, so you really needed to understand where and how things were laid out in front of you.
Especially if it's a new area that you're going into.
Yeah, again, something to mention is that these are places that they had never been before.
Right.
The unknown, complete unknown. And the thing is that their knowledge allowed them for efficient plannings of attacks, and they always strategized before they invaded. They had specific mission objectives along their routes of advance. And they also gave their subordinate commanders long enough rope that they weren't so tied to doing exactly what needed to be done. They trusted their commanders to achieve the larger mission with enough leeway to do as they felt necessary. Their detailed, imaginative planning was the key to their superior agility, and that was really key, agility.
Well, we talked about it as well in the past, the ability to have someone on the ground who makes decisions. And again, if no one can make a decision and everything has to go up, it's a bottleneck, and things don't happen. The ability to rely on your people on the ground and make the decision is crucial for the success.
Yeah. They would only work out a plan once they felt that they had a clear picture of all of the variables. So it was highly structured. And the advantage was that most of the time they were the ones doing the attacking as well, because everyone was so terrified of them. And think about it. Today, it seems kind of strange to imagine that we don't have information ahead of time, but imagine you're just sitting at home and then out of the mountains, this horde of people come and take over the world and just collapse empires, and information traveled a lot slowly. The Mongols basically, it like they came from nowhere is what it felt like for many of the other territories. And there was just destruction wherever they went.
A lot of these places never saw Mongols before. It wasn't like just going into to China. When they started to go into Persia, going into other parts of Europe, who saw people like that before? Maybe they heard stories, but who saw them?
And this is how the wrath of God cultivated as an idea as well. Interestingly, you mentioned Europe when they came in there. They had a secret treaty with Venetian merchants that helped them understand the strategic layout of what was going on in Europe. In exchange for information from these Venetian merchants, the Mongolians would eliminate competition in trade in exchange for constant intelligence reports on economic, political, cultural, social, and military status of different countries in Europe, which the Venetian merchants provided. The Venetian merchants' information was so detailed, in fact, that they were able to make like provisional maps of Hungary and Poland and Bohemia, and it was amazing. And the treaty provided like continuous information and intelligence on Europe for like 20 years. So it was very successful.
What you don't see is any movement by sea. That wasn't their forte.
They tried. They tried in Japan, and two storms saved Japan. Right. But they themselves, they had Koreans help them when they conquered Korea, and then the Koreans were better with boats, so they tried to bring them over. So again, horses don't like the sea.
No.
So another thing is that they maintained detailed records of all the major nations that they encountered and provided written records and briefings to their commanders. Now, the commanders themselves might not be able to read, but they were constantly briefed. And so it's just a clear pattern of the importance of intelligence.
Even Genghis Khan couldn't read.
Nope, could not read, but understood the value of the written word.
Yes. So if he gets a report, he can't read it.
He's reported orally.
That's why.
Yeah, verbal report. So one of the things that helped with all this intelligence gathering was a network that they called the YAM network. Y-A-M, the YAM, YAM. I'm probably pronouncing it wrong, but it was a network that was essentially these wayposts throughout and across the empire, separated apart by multiples of many miles, kind of like the Pony Express in the United States. It was wayposts that you could go to
Correct.
And then relay your messages. And so they got information from merchants and ambassadors and representatives and all these kind of things who, even in those functions, their primary goal was always information. That was always what the Mongols wanted. The YAM communication network allowed information to travel up to 125 miles a day. Some say 200 to 300 miles a day, but still a very far distance pre-cars and trains, if you think about it.
Well, as you said, it was special posts where they built them from nothing because they realized that to get information out there, they needed it.
Yeah, they would straighten roads and they would clear valleys to improve the efficiency. And these way stations were created so that the caravans could relay cargo and also messages. Now, merchants sought to gain access to this YAM system. It was not a public system, so it was also something that they could tax and regulate as well. The system was also fruitful for the army. Merchants and pretend merchants used it, as in people just using it for information purposes. Vital goods and information were moved through the YAM system, and security was also created around this system. All convoys had to have a tablet of authority, basically like a passport, which in Mongolian they called a garigor, and in Chinese it was a piazza. Now, depending on the rank of the people traveling, each of these garigors were made of different materials with a variety of illustrations. The highest level was the golden tiger head, and it had Genghis Khan's name, and the following was written on it.
By the name of Genghis Khan, endowed by eternal blue heaven, this man is empowered to act with the same freedom as I myself should exercise had I come in person.
Amazing that they developed passports back then.
Well, you need to have something of authority to say that this beholder of this information or need is sent by someone important, by the leader.
So how do relay stations work? Just to illustrate, you'd have one post. Let's say a merchant would arrive there with their horses and things, and either they themselves would then switch over to fresh horses and things and travel to the next one, or the message itself would then go to a different rider who would then travel to the next post, and then that rider would travel to the next post. And so,
well, it could be more than one post going simultaneously.
Yeah, of course.
So one brings information that's useful to other people,
yeah.
Then they send it from there to other people, and then it could spread out very quickly.
Exactly.
And it can get to very vast areas in the same time.
Right. And instead of, like we said before, where you ride your horse 30%, then go to the next horse 30%, 30%, 30%, here you would like ride the horse 90% to get to the next post, and that horse would rest. But then you could ride another 90% to the next one, and that's how they could go so quickly. Now, in the YAM system, messengers were always given preferential treatment. In fact, a Mongolian imperial decree from 1233 stated,
"If messengers coming from military headquarters meet any trading Muslim, the messengers, no matter what the merchant's business, shall confiscate their horses to ride between stations.
Now, they say Muslim because Muslims were the traders of the Silk Road trade network
of the East when they were going
that time,
yes,
period. So yeah, it illustrates the fact that if someone had an important message, that was the most important thing, and they could confiscate everything. And of course, these traders who would be using the YAM network were aware of this. And maybe there was some sort of compensation, or just get to the next network and they'll sort you out. But
so where was Genghis Khan at when this happened? Was he in the headquarters in Mongolia, or was he leading the troops?
At different time periods, he was in different places. He did lead troops into Khwarizmia later in his life. But yeah, I mean, it was constantly moving and doing different things, but there was a structure.
So information had to flow all the time, all over the place to him, because he had to make the decision eventually on all sorts of state matters.
Yeah.
And so the people were coming and going all the time. It was
all
like
the time, from everywhere.
Very interesting.
The YAM system was, in fact, the fastest way of sending messages across Asia until trains came about.
So. Okay.
Another thing that they used was fear. Fear was very, very important. They spread fear and used psychological warfare. They would upsell the strength of their forces. They tried to cause the enemies to surrender before a fight. Don't get bogged down, get more resources, all that kind of stuff. They used terror and intimidation. The Mongols' reputation preceded them. They were reported as merciless invaders who destroyed cities and slaughtered everyone. Always exaggeration on the size of their armies. Now, these weren't made-up things. People who resisted the Mongols met grisly, grisly, horrible fates. The Mongolians cultivated this fear, and they spread it. They would usually spare some enemies from the foes that they faced, so that they could then go and spread the tales of the horrible bloodshed inflicted on them.
What I understand, when they surrendered an army or a city, they always left one area where they could flee.
They would always leave open a gap for an army to flee in order for the army to break and run. Because if you're...
Okay.
And then when an army's breaking and running, you're easier to kill them. But what they would do is, after they defeated the army and captured the people, they wouldn't kill everyone. They would leave some people alive so that those people could then go and spread the stories of all of this horrible stuff. And also they would use human shields and attacks with their captives. They caused a lot of unpleasant things. At the same time, they would always promise not to kill those who offered no resistance and protect those who had useful skills, engineers, artisans, merchants. This way they could get some people to submit without a struggle. When a city was razed, though, everyone was killed, except for few, as we said, who spoke of piles of decapitated heads by gates of destroyed cities and bodies torn limb from limb and all this kind of stuff. Really grisly stuff. I mean, just destruction of entire populations. I mean, there's stories about every Mongol warrior going and killing 25 people inside of a town so they would all die. I mean, millions died at the hand of the Mongols. That said, there's an argument to be made that maybe their terror tactics potentially saved lives of the cities that would then immediately surrender to the Mongols because of the horrible stories that they heard. And all they had to do was pay tribute to them afterwards. But, you know, it's hard to say you saved lives when you butcher so many lives. When they did conquer, though, they would integrate those that they conquered into their highly structured military units, which were formed of a mix of different people from different tribes and families, which means that they didn't build loyalty to their tribes. Those were separated. They built loyalties instead to the larger purpose of the Mongol Empire. As we said, the units were organized in denominations of 10. So you'd have 10 people, not all from the same tribe, from different tribes and different things, and that would create a bond of unity to what they're serving then and there. If one person would leave, they would all die. And also, doing this denominations of 10, each leader was only ever in charge of 10 people. So of the 10, there would be the leader, and he'd be in charge of those guys. And then in the 100, there would be the leader of those, and he'd be in charge of just 10 people, the 10 guys who were in charge of the 10. Of the 1,000, he'd be in charge of the 10 guys who were each in charge of the 100, et cetera, et cetera. So your leader was only really like dealing with 10 people. So really very structured and organized.
Yes.
Also, their promotion system was based on merit, not birth. It was a very egalitarian system. Their spoils were evenly distributed as well. In fact, many were quite young who rose in the ranks. Their famous generals Subutai and Jebe, for instance, reached top ranks before their 25th birthdays, in fact. Genghis Khan made a point to reward and publicly praise subordinates that did well. Failure, though, was the quickest way for a leader's career to end. And all the Mongol commanders led by example and understood the Mongol operational concepts, allowing them to act independently while sticking with the overall plan.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
I mean, we've discussed this so many times about the importance of allowing people the freedom of operation and rewarding those that do well, and this connection between bringing intelligence and that flow of leadership in the chain of command, and how important that is.
Yes, here we're talking about military tactics, and this is a bit different because it's not an individual has to react or do things, or not necessarily in a clandestine way, but it's as a military. And so we're not going into military tactics here, but the ability of a leader to allow the people who are in the front line or on the battlefield to make the decision is crucial. If you hold everybody back and everybody has to ask a question to whoever it is before he acts, then you're not going to have a success as you would like to have. So it happens in intelligence, and it happens as well in military. Of course, the military is more structured, and its military may be a bit different. But again, it's how much you allow your people, they understand the situation, how much intelligence they have, and then they know what they have to do. It wasn't so complicated. You know, there was very simple rules. You know, if the guy doesn't fight, you don't have to kill him. If they give you a fight, you kill them. You keep the ones that you want to keep. We didn't mention here the relationship with their homes. You know, people just, not like today, they left and they never saw their home again.
A lot of times, yeah.
They went on this, you know, war that someone might have left when he was 14 or 15 and never came back. Not because he never came back because he wasn't alive, but he just was going on. Usually they would take local wives and raise families, and then the kids they have never knew their ancestors' home ground.
Well, the whole concept of home also is a little bit different because these were nomadic people of the steppes. The steppe tribes were nomadic, so the idea of a home was not necessarily one specific place. They were constantly moving, so in essence, their home was just getting bigger as they traveled. Now, later when they conquered non-nomadic people and went on campaign with them, that's a different story, and that was different for them. But yeah, for the nomadic tribesmen of the Mongol army, the core, that was kind of not as much of an issue, I would say.
But then what happens in the capital city? What happens?
But there wasn't a capital city for them. I mean, later there was. But essentially,
well, that's where the leader sits, or where his empire starts, right? That's where the messages are coming. There's the elders, the people who are. Because let's say, look, okay, he has all these spoils. Where does he take them? He just has them with him? So he got gold. He got silver. He has all these maps. He just travels with everything?
No,
well,
I mean,
what's the point?
They do go back to Mongolia and
so they
also
go back.
China, where they would later place
right.
their capital. But
so they go to somewhere where there's something that is more home, you would say.
Yeah, but that wasn't their home originally. That was conquered and built later.
I understand.
Is what I'm saying. You know, and when they would gather for war, it wouldn't even be there. They would perform a kurultai, which would be a gathering of the armies in Mongolia on these sacred mountains and different things. So again, it's not that traditional sense of a home. And when they would call their leaders, just the leaders would go back, not the whole army. Didn't need to bring the whole armies back from all the different areas of the world. Now, again, they were very efficient in their communications as well. They would use smoke signals and drums for communication across distances. They had fast horses always fresh to relay complex orders between units if they needed to. And they would always have scouts 70 miles in every direction of any moving army, ahead, to the sides, behind. They would also fight in silence, part of this psychological warfare, until an order was given later to yell and charge. And that would be when they would raise banners. And so starting fighting silently, and then boom, suddenly this explosion of thing. Very unnerving, I'm sure, to anyone who faced them. Also, the speed and the way that they fought was quite different. They wouldn't engage directly. It would be peppering them and assaulting and running and on horseback. So very kind of different fighting than a lot of what people were used to back then. They would never completely encircle the enemy, as we said, give them a way to run, which they inevitably took, as Sun Tzu suggested them to do. Leave a bear cornered against a wall and they'll fight to the death. Give it an opening and they'll take it. Nothing was left to chance if it could be known. That's why they had the scouts everywhere. The scouts would also raid. They would pick at different areas around, causing fear and confusion. When an army was found, that became immediately the objective of all of the troops in the area, who would then focus their efforts on that army, sending their information to the main group so that they could coordinate a joint attack. Additionally, they would constantly make their enemies waste time and combat prowess, tire them out. They would prepare the enemy for defeat before beginning their attack, avoiding costly set-piece battles, following that old advice of Sun Tzu.
I'm looking at it as well from something else. While you're talking about these things, I'm thinking to myself, you know, if they need original people to join them, you know, the youngsters who have now come to age, they need to bring them into the field. Or even, you know, the horses, you know, the horses wear out. You know, you're talking about 100,000 horses, 80,000 horses on the move all the time. They need somewhere to breed new stocks. They need somewhere where new reinforcements come. They need the logistics behind this is tremendous. Now, the information flows both ways. One is what's going on at home, what you have, and the other hand is what you're facing. We are looking at it as if, okay, they're on the move all the time, but no. They did an attack, and then the intelligence told them that the best time to attack is another couple of months for some reason. So they would stay put, and then reinforcements would come, you know, horses would get stronger, they would breed them. There would be more horses, more people coming in and joining from the hometown because, you know, they started off originally with a certain amount of people. The people get killed, wounded, sick, ill. People don't live to elderly ages in battlefield. You need reinforcements all the time. So there was always a flow of people coming in and out. But someone had to organize it. Someone had to be in charge of it. Someone had to decide who goes where and what time and when and everything. That's what I'm saying. Logistically, the intelligence that I'm looking at is to support the logistics, sometimes more than the battlefield, in my opinion.
Yeah, the logistics is more important than the actual. I mean, obviously, if you lose the battle, then it doesn't help.
No,
logistics are.
But they were not afraid.
Important.
They didn't lose too many battles. It wasn't like they were losing battles and they had to worry.
Right.
When they came to somewhere, they knew they were going to win. That was most of the cases.
Well,
okay, it will take
thing.
Us longer.
They avoided set piece battles and only fought them when they were going to win.
As
Sun Tzu said.
Yes.
Thus, a victorious army wins its victories before seeking battle. And that's what it is. You make sure you're winning before the battle. They would wear out their troops before fighting. And as you said, they weren't fighting every day for years and years and years. They would go on a campaign that would take whatever amount of time, and then there wouldn't be a campaign. Maybe that would be a year, maybe 2 years, maybe longer. Before they invaded Eastern Europe, they sent out scouts and prepared things 10 years in advance.
Yes. So it's not like they're on the move, not like an army today that's on the move all the time. You know, this is like a long war. They had time. There was no hurry except for the life expectancy of the leader.
The hurry was acting swiftly, and that was their advantage. They were able to move quickly, but they only moved after they had all the information. They wouldn't start the campaign until they had all the information. And their knowledge of time was critical, both of how long it took them to move, but also knowing how the enemy moved and how quickly they could do things. and that helped them stay a step ahead of their enemies. It was not a disgrace for a Mongol general to avoid battle. It was a disgrace to engage in battle that cost many lives, and even if they won, when victory could have been achieved at a lesser cost.
Yes, that's interesting.
They had a couple favorite tactics, which were like sweeping them from the flank or running away and peppering them. And then when they think they're retreating, they would close in and flank them again from behind. Or knowing that the enemy liked loot and stuff like that, they would leave their baggage trains supposedly abandoned. And then the enemy would come and get the baggage trains. And then they would swoop in again. Basically, all the Mongol tactics boiled down to bring the enemy in one way and then swoop around and get them from behind, which is most of medieval tactics in a lot of ways. But they were really good at it because they were agile and they were able to communicate well with each other through the drum signals and the smoke signals and all that kind of stuff.
It's interesting that they were able to manage all the different weathers. You know, when we look at Mongolia or the areas they came from, there were deserts there. There were very extreme cold and extreme heat. They had to maneuver through all these kinds of terrain. So they were able to do it because as well the animals they had with them, as well for feeding, were the right ones. They were not based specifically on one specific diet or one specific food, or if it's wheat or rice, or they just need it for one place. No, they didn't need something that grows specifically in one place.
They
just
had a reputation for eating anything.
Anything that moved, anything that grew, they could take and eat. No problem. If the horse dies, they'll eat the horse.
They would even use the bones. They would grind it down into soups, and they would eat anything. And that, they had a reputation of not being particularly hygienic either, but, you know.
They didn't wash their hands, as you're saying, before they went to eat?
No, they were hardy folks.
Okay.
They were hardy nomadic folks.
Okay. Remind me about that when we talk about washing hands.
Another tactic they had was attacking small settlements to drive the people out towards the larger towns. Then those refugees would be in the larger towns, which would take up supplies in that town.
That's a brilliant tactic.
Later, when they would siege the town, those people would be taking up the supplies and the siege would happen faster. And if they wouldn't take the people in, well, then the Mongols would round them up and use them to drive forward as a workforce, either to assault the walls or fill in ditches. And so they'd be caught between their own people in the town and the Mongols behind them and, you know, rock in a hard place or town walls and the Mongol bows. So not a good place to be in.
No.
A couple examples from specific invasions that just to illustrate some of the tactics that they used was when the Mongols were going into China, they really knew the value of attacking alliances. Their best chance to win against the Jin dynasty, which was in northern China, was to divide and conquer. The Jin, as I mentioned earlier, outnumbered the Mongols 100-1. They had more resources, they were fortified, and they had centuries of experience in fighting steppe nomads, such as them. The Jin expected to easily crush the Mongols, and as a result, you know, underestimated their capabilities. The Mongols exploited ethnic divides within Jin and northern China, because they knew that the Chinese Jin despised their ethnic Jurchen overlords, who were the controlling ruling class at the time. And so they convinced local governors and generals to defect to them in order to help defeat them. The Mongols also convinced the Khitans, another nomadic group in Jin territory, to join against the Jin. In southern China, the Song dynasty, which was the most technologically advanced dynasty and nation on the planet at the time, were the mortal enemies of the Jin. Now, the Jin explained to the Song that the Mongols were threatening both of them and that they should join together to defeat them. But Genghis Khan convinced the Song to attack the Jin instead. Old enemy, this and that. And again, underestimating these barbarians in the north, what do they know? We can get rid of the old enemy and then we'll take care of them. Also, before the Mongols advanced towards the Great Wall, they cultivated sympathies among the Unguts, an ethnic relative of the Mongols who were guarding a section of the wall 120 miles further to the west of where they had done a feint attack, which is where the Jin thought they were going to invade. And so when the Jin were preparing for that assault, because they were able to use the Unguts 120 miles away, they were able to get through the wall there and circle around and then crush
in the back.
Yeah. Both the Song and the Jin dynasties were eventually broken by the Mongols. The Jin dynasty breaking apart internally with enemies all over, and then falling to the Mongols. And Genghis Khan's grandson, Kublai Khan, would later conquer the Song dynasty. It would have been impossible to do so just through military might, you know, being outnumbered 100-1. They had to use clever divide-and-conquer tactics, and they did it with their intelligence. And later, with the technology that the Song and the Jin dynasties enabled them to have, such as siege technologies, they were able to go on and conquer many more things. There's one particular story which is quite fascinating, which is
speaking of spy
cats, this is the Thousand Cats story. So during their conquest of China, when they were besieging a heavily fortified city, the Mongols were unable to break the walls, and so they sent terms of peace. Instead, they would agree to lift the siege for 1,000 cats and birds from inside the city. Now, of course, the ruler of the city agreed and gathered the animals, sending them to the Mongols, who ordered their troops to tie oil-soaked cotton to the cats' tails and the birds, and then they sent them on fire out. And of course, because they were from the city, they rushed back into the city, which was made mostly of wood, setting the entire thing on fire. The defenders becoming overwhelmed, and during the chaos, Genghis attacked and conquered the city.
What happened to the cats?
They became spies for the CIA.
Okay.
They were hanged by Hartlepool.
No, it's a sad story.
Yes, it's sad. It's a
some cats survived to tell the story, to tell the tale.
The one that had 9 lives left.
Okay.
But a clever use of tactics there.
Yes, it is very clever.
Another example is in the Middle East, when a Mongol quote-unquote defector was able to reach Sultan Muhammad, who they were fighting, and he presented him with an intercepted message, supposedly from a vassal of Sultan Muhammad, that was sent to Genghis Khan. The message allegedly claiming of an alliance proposal. Now, fearing his empire was going to collapse, Sultan Muhammad then removed his forces from a strongly defensive position to go further back, thinking that he was about to be betrayed. So, you know, sowing the seeds of dissent, and of course they would have sent in their spies and got the information beforehand that there was potentially hostilities between that particular vassal and Sultan Muhammad, and then just playing on that fear.
Yes.
Again, brilliant. This is the Sun Tzu thing of the dead spy as well, and we've seen this also with Meinhardshagen earlier this season of plotting the fake attack,
yes.
You know, giving fake information to confuse the enemy.
And then you have to decide what you want to do with it.
And parsing the information is key. So they had superiority in their intelligence in that way, because if Sultan Muhammad was able to communicate clearly with his vassal and understand, maybe he would have been able to be dissuaded. But because there was already a built-in fear, let's say, of betrayal maybe, then they were able to use that. So
it's not only that. It's like the name of the Mongols coming in, it already had behind it a whole package that made it easier to convince someone to move out, better not deal with these guys. We talked about what is a name, what is a heritage. This is one of these things.
When they were in Russia and Europe, as I said, they implanted spies in the different territories 10 years before their actual invasion of Poland and Hungary, for instance, so they could really gather information and understand the lay of the land. When Subutai and Jebe, the generals I mentioned earlier, encountered the Rus army, which is in modern-day Russia, they were outnumbered 10 to 1. Okay, not the odds in China, but still, not good odds. And so they lured them away from their cities into open fields. How'd they do this? They intentionally left behind stragglers and what appeared to be defeated soldiers. And the Rus army following for 9 days, trying to pick them off, exhausting their supplies and horses before they were extended into this open field where the Mongols lit fires, obscuring the battlefield so they wouldn't know the number of Mongols. And that's when they attacked like a swarm of bees, surrounding them at all angles and using their mounted archers to their most effective nature as the Rus went into panic and ran, where they were chased down and butchered. When they were attacking Hungary, they understood that internal rivalries between Germany and the papacy would prevent a unified effort against the Mongols. And that's why they attacked when they did. And they were correct. The different warring nobles and vassals didn't work together in a coordinated effort to defeat them. So, all very clever planning. Knowing your enemy, it's important.
Yes. Again, military intelligence is different from other intelligence. Sometimes it's more tactical. It's more understanding what you need for the specific attack you need. And it was used in different ways. In this case, they knew that they needed something on the longer term. So what kind of people did they use? They're not going to use people that are foreigners, that are maybe people that we'd be suspicious. They'll use local people or merchants or people who are moving around, or make deals with, like, the people from Venice.
Yeah, the Venetian merchants.
And others who would give them information, and they would provide them with probably the spoils and the goods that they conquered. If it's silk, and if it was other merchandise that people in the West at the time when Europe did not see or did not have, and provide them that. And for that, they got information. And this information allowed them to conquer more places.
Also, you know, you would cut an alliance. You would say, hey, look, work for us, give us the information. And when we come, because we're coming, you will be spared. And you wanted to be spared against the Mongol hordes.
Yes, because especially when you have this information that they have, that they've been conquering vast areas of Europe.
I mean, they defeated the Chinese. It's like,
yes,
crazy. These people from nowhere, from the hills.
Yes, but I don't think the West really knew, or Europe really understood what China was at the time. It wasn't like China. It was a faraway place, but I don't think China had that same aura like it is today.
Well, first of all, it was the Jin and obviously the song, but still, the idea of the nation's closest to the nation's closest to the nation's closest. You know, yes. You defeated the nations on
the
my border.
They came all the way from
the nations
there.
From my border, who defeated the nations from my border.
I mean, people like who came from really the other side of the world, and they're coming to my doorstep with huge numbers, with different tactics, with they eat differently, they smell differently, they do things differently, they have different codes, different moral behavior. It frightened everybody.
According to contemporary counts, the population of China dropped 40% from 100 million to 60 million during the Mongol invasion and their rule. Russia's wealth and talent were devastated by two centuries of harsh rule. Southwest Asia was decimated. Many of the region's great cities were destroyed. And it took decades for farms to recover from the damage done to irrigation after ancient irrigation systems in Mesopotamia were destroyed, permanently creating a desert region. Mongol tactics, adaptability, organization, and agility were studied by experts throughout history. Gustavus Adolphus and Napoleon, as well as Russian cavalry officers, were still being taught Mongol tactics at the start of the 20th century. World War II German Field Marshal Erwin Rommel and American General George S. Patton both were well-read and admirers of Mongol achievements and the famous commander Subutai, who I mentioned earlier. Their legacy was that of the wrath of God coming down upon the nations who faced them. It was like they swept out of the wind like a plague.
Yes.
And decimated. And just as quickly, as swiftly as they decimated, it seemed like they vanished in some instances. Scary.
So what happens?
There's this whole thing that goes around from time to time about how a huge portion of the population can trace their lineage to Genghis Khan, as their ancestry in all the different areas that he conquered, which is interesting. He had a lot of wives later.
Well, it's not only him. It's all his people. You know, they didn't go home for the weekend.
No. War and espionage. From the very start, with Sun Tzu, The Art of War, and then talks about espionage. Is there a purpose for espionage without war?
I don't think necessarily that espionage leads to war or war leads to espionage. I think war stands on its own and intelligence on espionage stands on its own.
Is it not the same thing?
No, not necessarily. War is a result of something you do according to the information that you have or don't have. Not necessarily has to be connected. You want to know what the other merchant is selling so that you can sell it for cheaper.
Isn't that a form of war?
Well, conflict? It is for a purpose. You could say, is the intelligence collected for a purpose? Yes. Is the purpose automatically a war? No. It could lead to war as well. If you feel
or prevent war, but...
Look, most wars in the old days, and even today, you would say, are over resources. So if you have something that someone else has or doesn't have, and you want it, you will do things to get it. If they have water and they have wells and you don't, you want it, you find a way to get hold of it. If they have fertile land that you feel that you need for your people and you don't have enough, then you collect information and then you go and get it. If you have to move your people from one place to another and you need to find what the land is up to, you get information, like what Moses did. The same thing. He sent out spies to see what the land is like. Then, according to the land, for invasion. Yes, but that is for invasion. But is automatically intelligence related to war? I don't think so. I think it's one angle of it.
So what is the purpose of espionage without war?
The purpose of espionage?
Without war.
You tell me. I don't think there's a direct connection.
All espionage is related to conflict. Either preventing conflict or getting the upper hand in conflict, whether that be getting the upper hand militarily in a conflict or getting an upper hand economically or business-wise?
You're going into a philosophical question. Knowledge, as we said, is power.
Right.
Now, if knowledge is power, and so you say, is power automatically means war? No, it means you have to make a decision according to the information you have. If you want to make it to war, okay. If you want to make it to something else, it's okay. It's not automatic. From the first days of mankind, one was envy of another person, even if there was not many people around. If he liked his wife or didn't want his wife, if it was King David, he wanted a certain wife and he saw a nice lady and he wanted her. So what did he do? He decided to send the guy to a battlefield and then he can have the wife. All over history, you have information that leads to something. You're saying that it's connected to war. Okay. It's not only war.
It's power.
Power.
The upper hand.
Yes. You want to know things.
Superiority. You could say that espionage of getting information, you know, if you're a farmer and you want to know what the land is out there so that you know how to plant your seeds well.
That's not a war, is it?
No, but it's
a war of survival.
You could say it's conflict against nature, right? So that you can get the upper hand against it. So I guess we are getting a little bit into philosophy.
Yes,
Is deception the key to all espionage?
You're asking me big questions here on these things.
Well, I mean, they use deception. I mean, deception was a big part of how they functioned.
In our podcast, we did a lot of deceptions and a lot of places where using intelligence to get the other side to feel or to think something else, that is the power of using the intelligence the right way.
What would you do if you were facing the Mongol horde and you were the intelligence advisor of some neighboring kingdom?
What kind of question is that? First of all, you would run. You would run very fast.
How big is the kingdom? What are we doing?
How long do I have to get to a safe place? Look, it's the information you need is not if he's coming, is if he plans to come to you. If he plans to come to you and you know you're on the path, and on the other hand, he spares you and lets you live, then you say, okay, in those days, maybe that was the right thing to do. Because in the end, the Mongols disappeared. It's a matter of time. They can't, again, it's a matter of when we talked in the beginning, what is the purpose of his conquering?
He tried to conquer the known world.
He wanted to conquer everything he could because he felt that's what he wanted to do. Okay, all right. What was the purpose? What was the meaning behind it? Did he have a religion that he wanted to spread? No. Did he ask all the spoils to come to him? No. All the women to come to him? No. So it was like a lot of leaders who have this appetite for conquering and taking as much as they can. In the end, the world has a way to balance itself out.
What's the difference between espionage at war and espionage not at war, if any?
It's too big of a question. I'm not going to answer it now like this. Espionage at war is more tactical. Okay, where's my enemy tomorrow? It's intelligence of where should I put my guy? Where should I put the sniper? Where's the army? What's the tactics? This is something else. I would say there's different kinds of intelligence. There's intelligence, tactical, and strategic. Strategic, you're looking at what are the aims of a certain country. What are they trying to do? What are their resources? How much can they spread it out? This is not something you're going to find on the battlefield.
So you could say that they were very good at combining these two elements of espionage. They had the strategic overview as well as the tactical understanding.
In those days, it was combined because one was connected to the other. There was the intelligence was not in the headquarters in some tent in Mongolia. If you wanted to know what the Mongols are up to, you had to see it on the battlefield. You didn't have to go all the way to Mongolia to get the intelligence. What they want to do, you won't find it there. If you're the Mongol and you're looking at a certain area to take over, you want the tactical information because your objective is tactical. It's to take over a certain area. So you need to know the area, the plan, who you're facing, what are the resources. And again, what I liked about this is that how much of the intelligence was connected to logistics. That I find the interesting part of this whole episode of the Mongols and Genghis Khan. The amount of information that had to go through and arrive to him must have been conducted in a way where he has to rely on it. He shouldn't be told things that he wants to hear. So he has to rely that the information he gets is completely correct. And we don't have any stories just saying that people were afraid to tell a story if they thought it won't be pleasing for the leader. And that's very important when we come to intelligence. And it comes all over the we talked about it in the past as well. Now, especially when you're on a war.
He valued accurate intelligence.
Yes. Now, they didn't lose so many battles, but they didn't go into battle when they didn't have the right intelligence. Now, that's important as well to say. And those times when they didn't go into battle, they were not under attack. No one really rebelled against them, or at least were not aware that they actually suffered some defeats, at least not in his time, in his hometown. It wasn't like the rebellions in the cities.
In the beginning when he fought in Mongolia before he was the empire, he lost some things.
Yes, but afterwards there was nothing. He wasn't worried so much about what goes on in his backyard because it was under control.
Yeah, the Chinese generally speaking.
I think the use of psychological warfare was very important as well. The fact that you're able to go into a place and even before you go in, everybody already knows what the outcome is going to be, and therefore you already make the decision accordingly, is a great asset for you when you go and attack. You won half the war, is already won.
A Persian chronicler wrote of Genghis Khan that he was adept at magic and deception, and some of the devils were his friends. And legend has it that Genghis Khan's last words to a few faithful followers were, "I have conquered for you a large empire, but my life was too short to take the whole world. That I leave to you."
And he very nearly did.
Yes, he did. And I hope he knew to read before he finished off.
He did not, as far as I'm aware. This was Spies and Lies. Thanks for listening. And remember, if you hear the Mongols coming,
prepare your horse and start running away.
Spies and Lies is a Grumpy Golem production, with original scoring and mastering by Julian Dussault. If you enjoyed listening, don't forget to share with your friends and leave a comment or review wherever you listen from. And remember, if you have any questions for us for the Q&A, send them our way. And of course, you can always leave us a nice review wherever you listen from. If you have any questions or subjects you'd like for my father and I to cover, drop us a message and we'll do our best to get back to you. Until next time.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Your personal info, like addresses, phone numbers, and more, are collected and sold by data brokers. But Aura steps in, scanning the web, sending you alerts, and requesting your info be removed. Get Aura's full toolkit, including credit and transaction monitoring, a password manager, VPN, and more. Get a 14-day free trial at aura.com/safety. That's aura.com/safety.